Hi everybody, my name's Ruth Barson. I'm a senior lawyer at the Human Rights Law Centre. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations. I pay my deep respects to their elders, both past and present. I'd also like to acknowledge the Aboriginal people here today, and in particular, Yorta Yorta woman Meena Singh, who we are privileged to have on the panel. I'd also like to recognise that colonisation was not a historic moment in time, but rather an ongoing event and structure that continues to manifest in injustice today. One of those vexed and ongoing consequences is that of entrenched inequality in our justice system and the consequential over-imprisonment of Aboriginal people, which we are here to discuss. The last 10 years has seen an almost 90% increase in the number of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people being locked up, resulting in one in four people in prison today being Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander. Nationally and overall, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are 13 times more likely to be imprisoned than the non-Indigenous population. The picture for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women and young people is far worse. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people are 24 times more likely to be imprisoned than the non-Indigenous population, and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women now constitute the fastest growing prisoner demographic in Australia and are imprisoned at 34 times the rate of the non-Indigenous women's population. The criminal justice system is undoubtedly producing both racial and gender inequalities. Whereas Victoria was once heralded for its comparatively low Aboriginal imprisonment rate, last year the Australian Bureau of Statistics reported that Victoria now has the second fastest growing Aboriginal imprisonment rate in the country. While the statistics are bleak, importantly, around the country, we can see examples of Aboriginal communities themselves proactively responding to the inequality of the criminal justice system. From the Ponki mediators on the Tiwi Islands, who provide traditional early intervention and mediation services, to the Walpri Law and Justice Committees in the desert, whose authority is respected by the magistrates when sentencing, to the Justice Reinvestment Trial in Bourke, to Koori Courts and the Justice Forum here in Victoria. It is unequivocal that Aboriginal people, communities and organisations must be at the centre of any response. Today, to discuss both the challenges and culturally relevant ways of responding to the issue of Aboriginal over-imprisonment, we are lucky to have three fantastic people. Meena Singh is the Principal Legal Officer of the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service. Prior to this role, she was the Strategic Advisor at VALS and has worked as an independent legal consultant and as a senior lawyer at Victoria Legal Aid in criminal, civil and human rights law. Ben Shockman is the Director of International Advocacy at the Human Rights Law Centre. He has recently completed a 9-month Meyer Innovation Fellowship, which involved looking at innovative ways of addressing over-imprisonment both here in Australia and overseas. He also leads much of the Centre's Indigenous rights work. Patricia Carvelis will be facilitating today's conversation. Patricia hosts Radio National's Drive program and prior to this was a senior journalist at The Australian. Inherent in Patricia's reporting is a commitment to telling the stories of Aboriginal people, organisations and issues, and she has often been responsible for documenting both inequalities and good news stories when no other journalist has engaged in the issues. I'd like to thank you all for coming today, and in particular I'd like to thank King and Wood Mallesons for generously hosting us. If you are planning on tweeting throughout the event, please use the hashtag #ChangeTheRecord. I'll now hand over to you, Patricia.
Thank you. I'll be trying to get this thing on. Is this thing working? Oh, fantastic. Hi. Thank you very much. Yes, I am Patricia Carvelis, and I'm going to frame some questions for these fantastic people who are the experts. So I'm just interested in what the experts have to say. I'll start with you, Ben, if I can. if we can kind of briefly go into this, because I think that the solutions are probably what people are here for. I think a lot of people here have a high interest and knowledge base. But why are we seeing some of these staggering rates of Aboriginal imprisonment in your view?
Thanks, Patricia. Well, I mean, I guess we don't need to go through the statistics that Ruth just took us through. So generally, when I've been looking at why over-imprisonment rates are so high here in Australia generally, and particularly for Aboriginal people, the short answer really is poverty and disadvantage. And I've become a little bit of a drawing person over the last 9 months while I've doing this, but to try and put it in a, I guess, some kind of framework, when you look at the kind of drivers of why it is that people end up in prison, there's this process that essentially starts with poverty and disadvantage. So I'm not going to go through any statistics, but if you look at the prisoners here in Victoria, they are essentially people who have lower education rates, lower employment rates, they'll have lower health outcomes, particularly mental health, acquired brain injury, other forms of disability. So you start to see that there are people who have multiple and complex needs. They then come into contact with the criminal justice system. There are particular laws that will impact on people disproportionately, sentencing options that may or may not be available to judges, policing practices that target particular groups. They then end up in prison. Prisons are pretty awful places to be and aren't very good at rehabilitating people. And then they get kind of re-entered into the community, if you like, and they end up precisely back in the environment where they started. So it's no accident, really, that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are so overrepresented when we know that, factually, on every single social and economic indicator, they're so much more worse off. So this probably should look like an actual cycle, but in line with the theme of wanting to break the cycle of over-imprisonment, I thought we'd at least try and keep it on some kind of linear trajectory.
I like that. Mina, we've always had, actually, Aboriginal people overrepresented in the justice system and in the prison system. But what I can't get my head around, and you know we've talked before, I'm trying to, is why it's getting so much worse, right? Because it's actually getting worse. It's one thing if it's just not improving, and we all think that's bad. It's actually getting worse, which is quite... makes me want to fall off my chair, but I'll try not to because that would be odd. Yeah. But...
Just before I start, I'd also like to pay my respects to the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, whose land on which we're meeting today, and also pay respects to the elders past and present, and the elders here with us in the room. But thank you, Patricia, for that question, because it is getting worse, and as we heard from Ruth, Victoria's gone from having one of the best rates, or lowest rates of Aboriginal imprisonment, to the second highest. And you know, if you start with an individual in the centre and look out at sort of a range of circles and spheres of influence onto an individual, we can look at what's happening specifically in a person's own environment in terms of what's happening in their family relationships, what factors of disadvantage are affecting their life. Then if we take it out a sphere further, we can look at what sort of environmental, social, political factors are coming into it. Particularly in Victoria, we've seen a very heavy law and order agenda with lots of changes in legislation, removing things such as suspended sentences, changes to the Bail Act, changes to family violence legislation that have meant the options available for dealing with problems in people's lives from a legal perspective are much more limited. And then if we take out this circle even bigger, and we can also just look at a space and time issue and look at the historical factors of colonisation, dispossession, breakup of families, and breakup of the sense of identity and belonging to communities. That also has a huge impact. And there seems to be, from my point of view as an Aboriginal person, there seems to be a lot more of a sense of the other in the Australian community, I think, in that. Very much an us and them type of mentality. We see it very much also with asylum seekers. We see more of a backlash more and more with refugee groups, migrant groups, but we're always seeing it with Aboriginal groups. And I think there partly is a sense of why haven't we figured this out yet? Why haven't we addressed these issues? But the reality is that we keep trying to apply very short-term measures to what is essentially centuries of issues that impact.
So let's get to what might work, because clearly what we're doing isn't working. We've established that in the statistics paint that picture. You don't have to make the argument. It's kind of unarguable. They're facts. So what might work? how dramatically do we have to change the framework? I'll start with you, Ben. And is it really a state and territory issue? Because I know that this new campaign that's been launched is about also pushing the federal government to step up. But it is, law and order, as we know, is a state and territory issue. So how do you kind of do that?
What might work? Well, I think one of the, especially hearing Mina speak as well, we have such a narrow focus on trying to address over-imprisonment. So if we think about most of the things that governments seek to do, particularly at the state and territory level, the large focus is on kind of harsher criminal justice system responses. Just to continue, I guess, the diagram there, a lot of our focus tends to be on the criminal justice system and prisons, and it doesn't have this more holistic understanding of why it is that people end up in the prison system. So I think that's one answer I would give, is that there needs to be a much more holistic view taken that actually looks to address the underlying social and economic and cultural causes, the impacts of colonisation, as Mina's talked about. The other thing that I've come to learn more and more is that I do think that there's a big structural issue at play in terms of the way that government currently goes about business, if you like. We have the federal structure, as you talked about, we've got a whole lot of different departments. So you end up with all of these services that are kind of done to communities that happens in this really sort of fragmented and siloed way. So if you're a rights holder that has multiple complex needs within that system, and we hear this about Aboriginal communities, the fly-in, fly-out type services, there's communities of 1,000 people where they literally have 60 or 80 or 100 different services that all come in, all to provide one particular service. And there's very few of those that actually deal with the sort of holistic nature of the individual and the community. So I think that there is a structural issue that's also at play in terms of the way that government goes about business, and the federal dynamic is certainly one of those issues.
Could I ask all of you to move the microphones closer to you?
Certainly.
Yes.
Might be a bit too close.
I thought someone had an answer for structural issues for us.
I was hoping too we might get that eureka moment. Mina, what sort of approaches, and obviously you would have a very Victorian perspective. What's failing in Victoria? What needs to happen?
I think there needs to be much greater, we talk about it all the time, needs to be much greater dialogue and involvement from Aboriginal communities and Aboriginal organisations on the ground for people who are actually delivering the services. The thing is with Aboriginal organisations is that they're specifically set up to help Aboriginal communities. They're born out of those communities. They're born out of a response to deal with an issue. So if you look at ALSs across the country, ALBALs in Victoria, born over 40 years ago, over trying to address an issue of over-representation and people not having access to legal services. So there's a lot of ground knowledge, there's histories of knowledge, and these organisations have really seen, they've survived through the changes of government, they've seen the policy changes, they've seen the cyclical nature of funding and all the rest of it, that impacts on it. There's a lot of cultural, a lot of professional, just a lot of knowledge that needs to really be tapped into. It's really frustrating when you see things such as the recent the Indigenous Advancement Strategy, that the funding that was put out through the Prime Minister and Cabinet Department, that basically had lots of Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal organisations effectively re-tendering for their services. Now, what we've seen from that is that less than half of the money that's gone out to, as part of that IAS funding strategy, less than half of it has actually gone back to Aboriginal organisations, the organisations on the ground who actually have the connectivity to the work. And I think that's a real problem, because there's a real disconnect between what the issues on the ground are and who's holding the purse strings, I guess. And there's a tendency from government to see issues as a real silo, in silo ways of understanding. Aboriginal people and communities know how connected issues are. As a legal service, we know that we're at the pointy end of people's lives. And I might have to stand up now, sorry. If we look at Ben's diagram, where we come into it as a legal service is in a really narrow space of time here. This arrow is much longer. It extends as long as a person's life.
Should have written not to scale on my diagram.
I didn't give you forewarning. But as Ben said, we're trying to address legal issues that are born out of non-legal circumstances. And that's where the greater understanding needs to come from. What's happening with people? We talk about that there's over representation, but Aboriginal people are 13 times more likely to end up in prison. In Victoria, an Aboriginal child is 13 times more likely to be removed and put into out-of-home care than a non-Aboriginal child. What we know from that is children in out-of-home care are much more likely to come into contact with juvenile offending for a whole range of reasons, but none the least of being that they're being removed from their family for the first time, they're being put in a place that could be kilometres and hours away from where their home is. They're being removed from communities, and kids often lash out, as kids do, but that's leading into criminal behaviour as well. So it's understanding that when someone comes to legal services with a legal problem, they're actually coming with a whole set of issues. Legal services aren't equipped in the traditional way of lawyering to deal with a whole range of issues. But we are often the point where these issues first start getting talked about. So it's almost like if you have a legal problem, that's the catalyst to actually start pulling apart people's issues. So if we talk about things like problem-solving courts, such as Koori courts, where it takes time to actually sit, it takes magistrates, a judge, it takes elders, it takes lawyers, but it also takes that face-to-face dialogue with someone who's offended and to actually say, what are the issues here? And that's often the first time that people are being asked about these concerns. And I've been sprouting off a bit about Brian Stevenson, who most of you will know is the human rights and death row lawyer from America, and he talks about the idea of proximity and getting close to a person's issue. And it's almost like we need a translator between people's stories on the ground and experiences, translate that into what the numbers, the statistics about 13 times more likely, what that actually means, and actually have a conversation that says, what are the issues being dealt with? In his book, he talks about that there's someone on death row who says, in the last few hours of my life, I've been asked, do you need anything? Do you need, can I get you anything? Can I help you with anything? If those questions are asked much earlier in a person's life, who knows what the outcome might be for those people? So I think it's getting close to the issues, not thinking, and also taking time. It takes time to nut out these problems. On a really practical level, a Koori court hearing at the magistrate's court can take an hour compared to the 5-10 minute maybe plea that happens in mainstream courts, because they're trying to get to the root of the issues that are being felt.
So you mentioned the Indigenous Advancement Strategy, which is the federal grants scheme. We know law and order is determined on state and territory level, and then we've got effectively the federal government in our federation in charge, if I can use that loosely, of Indigenous affairs. Is that part of the problem? And does it need, like we're seeing with domestic violence at the moment, a kind of COAG level national approach? Prime Minister leaders actually putting together a kind of consistent strategy? That's how I'm seeing it, Ben.
Short answer is yes. I think that, so at the most recent COAG meeting, for the first time, the issue of Aboriginal over-imprisonment was placed on the agenda, and there were some issues that were outlined there around how COAG might want to deal with it. I mean, the federal structure does create a lot of issues, and we have a federal government at the moment who is a little bit, we don't want to commit to justice targets, largely because we don't have a lot of control over that space when it comes to the law and order area. That is a state responsibility. But once again, I'd highlight that is a very sort of narrow approach and a narrow view that's being taken. I think the Indigenous Advancement Strategy, for all of the, I think, quite right concerns that organisations are raising about the way that the money's being dispensed and who are the organisations that are getting it, it is almost an opportunity in some ways to look at how that funding can actually be provided in a more holistic way. So I think that there might be some scope for, rather than the legal services being funded out of the Department of Justice, the health services being funded out of the Department of Health, to have projects that are put up and projects that are supported by government at the federal level. So I think there needs to be leadership that takes place. One of the observations, and we might come to talking about my fellowship in a moment, but a lot of the other countries that I looked at, a lot of federal countries in that tour, they all have a national body that plays a really important both data and monitoring and evaluation role, but also a policy development role. I think that's a real gap here in Australia, and people might have all sorts of reasons and have much better ideas about why that's the case, but I do think that would be one area where the federal government could really look at a leadership role in, as we've talked about, this increasing crisis of Aboriginal over-imprisonment. The other big development, I think, that is happening at the state and territory level is support for a number of pilot projects that are happening around Australia. So, for example, Ruth mentioned it in the introduction, in Bourke in New South Wales, the New South Wales government has part-funded a pilot, which is a justice reinvestment pilot, to support the Bourke community to actually have that kind of localised, tailored decision-making, coming together and talking about, well, what are the issues actually in our community, what are the specific issues in our community, and what are some of the solutions or ideas that we might have about how we go about addressing all of the underlying social and economic disadvantage that I've spoken about.